Blog Talk Radio.
This is Robert Greeno. This is Robert Greeno. General Quarters. General Quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody, for our pre-Christmas ho-ho-ho edition of Midrats. As a reminder for those who are joining us live, make sure and log in to the chat room so you can keep company with the usual suspects. It's also an opportunity for you, if you have some observations or perhaps a question for either myself, Eagle One, or our guest, you can fold it in there. Eagle One primarily is riding herd there. I'll be there as well. We'll try to fold that in to the conversation. And if you've missed a few of our episodes, or if you're new to Midrats and would like to hear what we've done with some of our other guests, you can always tap into the Blog Talk Radio archive of all of our shows, dating back to first Sunday of this year. Or you can set yourself up to get the podcast on iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. We have a guest for the full hour today to go back and talk about some of the issues that our sister maritime service is involved with, that is the U.S. Coast Guard. And our guest to help us with that is going to be Dennis Bryant, Captain, United States Coast Guard, retired. He's presently at the head of Bryant's Maritime Consultant. He's a graduate of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, and after a little bit of time there, he spent 27 years on active duty, retiring in 1995. He has a good broad breadth of experience that we usually see with our Coast Guard guests that we have on board here. He made three Arctic patrols and addition to the icebreaking tanker Manhattan during the Northwest Passage Transit in 1969. He then went to law school, and from there he served in a variety of legal assignments, including the agency Law of the Sea Officer. He supervised implementation of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. After retirement, he joined the law firm of Haight, Gardner, Poor, and Haven, specializing in government regulation of ships. He's also advised clients throughout the world on compliance with international U.S. and state laws impacting vehicle operations. In 2009, he moved over to the maritime regulatory consulting part of the business. He has a longstanding industry daily newsletter that can now be found on his blog. In addition, he's done a lot of writing and also speaking engagements on maritime issues internationally. Dennis, welcome to Midrats.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Great. Hey, when I was looking over your background, one thing that kind of caught my eye, because I think it's a good opportunity to talk about how when a significant act takes place, how that matures over time. And you were present at the birth of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, and I was wondering if you could just take for a minute to briefly describe what it was, why it came into existence, and when you look back on how it has matured over the last 20 years, how has it manifested itself and its impact on both the maritime and the energy sectors of the American economy?
Well, I like to point out that I did not have anything to do with the authoring of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, but I did supervise its implementation. We had a team in the Coast Guard. We promulgated, I think, 44 separate rulemakings to implement the Open 90. The act, as most people know, was a direct result of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989 in Prince William Sound, Alaska, which, while it was not the biggest oil spill in U.S. history, was the most visible and the most prominent. The public reacted and Congress reacted, and Open 90 was adopted unanimously by the U.S. Congress. The act made a number of very beneficial changes, including such things as double hulls for tankers, and improved and enhanced financial responsibility, and it also greatly enhanced the type of damages that could be recovered and made them more easily recoverable. The oil industry and the shipping industry reacted very quickly to that passage of that statute, and the amount of oil entering the waters of the United States from ships dropped dramatically immediately after passage of the act, and it had very little to do with the regulations that I supervised the writing of, because it took us 3 years to get the first regulations out, and the decrease in the amount of oil being spilled happened immediately. So the big change was the mindset of the industry. They quickly determined that it was cheaper to avoid oil spills than it was to clean them up afterwards. And that has pretty well remained true within the shipping industry since 1990. The recent oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico indicates that maybe the energy industry didn't quite get the message, because once again, it seems to be that the I've read that human factors was a major factor in that oil spill. They did not appreciate the risks that they were taking, which is somewhat similar to what happened with the Exxon Valdez.
Eagle One.
Well, one of the things that we haven't discussed on the show, but which I think you are well versed in, is the increasing criminalization of mariners for various activities. And would you like to discuss a little bit what is going on and what we've seen as a trend recently?
The criminalization was kind of a side effect of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And the Department of Justice was upset about the oil spill. The federal government was upset, and the American public was upset. And the Department of Justice, as far as I can see, searched around and said, "Well, what can we charge them with?" And focused on two particular statutes that had been somewhat ignored in the past. The Refuse Act of 1899 was enacted over 100 years ago, obviously, mostly to address people who at that time were intentionally throwing trash, garbage, refuse, things such as that, mostly into New York Harbor, but also in other waterways. And the statute was written very broadly, but with some very loose language, which, if you read it literally, it indicates that any deposit of refuse into the waters of the United States constitutes a criminal act. The courts initially did not read the statute literally. They required that the prosecutor show intent on the part of the defendants. Otherwise, they wouldn't allow the prosecution to proceed. But then later on, it became somewhat looser, and they started reading it literally, but it wasn't used very often. And generally, using prosecutorial discretion, it was only used in serious cases. Likewise with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which, as the name implies, implements the Migratory Bird Treaty with Canada, which makes it a crime to take migratory birds. It was once again enacted because duck hunters primarily were just blowing the birds out of the sky and putting them at risk of extinction. So they made it a crime to take migratory birds, which is almost every bird in the United States. And once again, the statute was written loosely, and there's no mention of intent. But for the most part, prosecutors really only charged the more serious cases. But about 10, 12 years ago, when various hunters felt they were being unfairly persecuted for shooting too many birds out of the sky, they got the law changed so that for hunting, you pretty well have to show specific intent that the hunter did plan on shooting this particular migratory bird out of the sky without a permit. But that exception doesn't apply elsewhere. Well, the prosecutors charged Exxon with criminal violations of the Refuse Act of 1899 and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, both of which, under modern interpretations, are strict liability crimes, meaning you don't have to show any intent, you don't even have to show negligence. So if oil enters waters of the United States, you violated the Refuse Act of 1899, and if a migratory bird is harmed, either killed or gets oil on its wing, something of that nature, then you've got a violation of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Faced with the fact that they were being charged with crimes for which there was no defense, Exxon pled guilty, and we have now seen, since 1989, a number of maritime cases where ship owners and operators are charged with a violation of these two acts, and they're forced to plead guilty because they have no alternative. Generally, other crimes are also alleged, but because those two crimes are strict liability with no defense, you take the package and plead guilty.
This is always a dangerous thing to do with a couple of attorneys in the room, but I want to throw out a hypothetical here for you. You know, listening to that description, is if I have a duty driver who has to go pick up somebody at the airport, he's in his official duties, and he's been sitting around, and he's drunk, and he gets in a car, and he's halfway to the airport, runs off, runs over some poor old lady pushing a shopping cart and kills her. Now, he'll be tried out in town for vehicular manslaughter, though he performs something in his official duties. In line with what you're talking about, criminalizing mariners, and you know, ships are running aground on a regular basis. You know, when you talk about environmental impact, we think of the one that ran aground right off of the reef in Pearl Harbor. Very environmentally sensitive areas we work in. So if you have a Navy or a Coast Guard skipper run his ship aground, rips open, oil goes every place, or, God forbid, it's a nuclear-powered ship and you have some type of radiation of some type leaking around, could a potentially commanding officer of a ship find himself in criminal court in that same way for those same statutes be ran aground?
Theoretically, yes. Generally, military personnel, active duty military personnel, are prosecuted, if at all, through the military justice system. But that's not necessarily always the case. But yeah, and there was an unfortunate case. Just a couple years ago, getting back we're getting to oil water separators, where a Coast Guard engineering officer, a Coast Guard cutter in Hawaii, directed the discharge of waste oil directly overboard, and got caught and was court-martialed. So yes, same statute as would apply to a civilian. The only difference was that it was tried before a court-martial instead of in a civilian court. But yes, the same basic laws apply to military personnel as apply to civilians.
Well, let's talk about the oily water separator issue, which largely seems to be the way they seem to be convicting people on that is through their falsifying the logs of what they're doing. You know, what exactly is that law? Why does it exist, and how do you violate it, and are there any defenses to it?
Well, the ships naturally accumulate waste products in the bilges, a lot of water, some oil, some other chemicals in there. Back in about 1970, the International Maritime Organization mandated that merchant vessels install and operate oil water separators to separate out most of the oil in the water from the bilges and put it in special holding tanks, and then pump the relatively clean water overboard. And it was originally set at 15 parts per million, 100 parts per million for what constituted an authorized discharge. And they also had to maintain a record book of how to handle their waste products. The system worked fairly well. The machinery generally did its job, and everyone was relatively satisfied with the process. And then about 15 years ago, the IMO greatly increased the requirements for oil and water separators, and they said you can only discharge wastewater if the oil in it is no more than 15 parts per million. The manufacturers of oil water separators says not to worry, our old devices can handle that, and everything is fine. Turns out the old devices couldn't handle it, and they kept breaking down, the filters kept clogging, all sorts of problems. Finally, like I said, 15 years ago, the IMO adopted a requirement for a new generation of oil and water separators that really could handle the problem. The new devices do work quite well, not perfect, but quite well. The problem is that the IMO did not sunset the old devices. So most ships operating today are still using the old first generation oil and water separators that don't work properly. The chief engineers are put in a Hobson's choice situation where if they can't keep the oil water separator operating, they can either shut down the ship at great expense to the owner, or they can pump the waste water overboard directly and continue to operate, but then that requires them to falsify the oil record book. I have advocated publicly for some time now that ship owners should invest in the new generation of oil water separators. Most of them haven't done that, placing their chief engineers at great risk of prosecution. you know, it's a false official statement to indicate in the oil record book that you operated the oil water separator properly when you know you didn't. It's clearly a crime, but it's a crime of necessity on the part of the chief engineers, because they'll just get fired and get replaced with someone who will falsify the log for the owner. Difficult situation. I sympathize greatly with the chief engineers, and wish, first of all, that the IMO had put a sunset provision into the new regulation, and secondly, that the ship owners would spend the money, and they're not that expensive, spend the money and buy new oil water separators.
Has there been a case where a chief engineer has been charged and they've gone to court and he said, hey, I'm just doing what the company says, or is it just not being enforced to that degree?
The chief engineers routinely say that, but that's not a defense. The crime exists. There have been a few occasions, and hopefully those will increase, where the ship owner itself is prosecuted, and forced to pay penalties. They've been forced to pay sometimes multi-million-dollar penalties for this behavior. But like I said, I still haven't seen where the ship owners have fully gotten the message and replaced all those old oil and water separators. Obviously, the ones who get caught immediately replace the oil and water separators. But the instances where the old oil and water separators are still being used is way too large, and like I said, it puts the chief engineers in just horrible situations.
It almost sounds like it's one of those classic cases where the system is waiting for a chief engineer to be fired for refusing to lie, and then he gets the right attorney to take the company to court. I don't know if you can fold in a whistleblower act with that or anything, but it's just one of those things that you just have to wait for the right case to make it so painful for industry that they will just do it to avoid the pain?
True, but as we know, the vast majority of merchant vessels on the oceans today are foreign flag.
Right.
Whistleblower provisions that are in the U.S. law won't work very well for them. There's only a small handful of U.S. flag vessels that are even in a situation where they might be able to take advantage of this.
Shifting oil sources for a moment, one thing I found fascinating during the Gulf oil blowout that we saw this year was the interaction between the state governors and their desire to take quick action as the oil was coming ashore, and the open conflict they had with the federal government, whether we're talking about the executive branch or the Coast Guard or the EPA, who were, depending upon who you talk to, either making sure that worse damage wasn't done or being classic bureaucrats and slowing action down. From your perspective, were the governors in the right there, or is there more refinement that needs to take place to be able to better take action in a timely manner in situations like that?
I think that the federal government did not react as vigorously as they should have at the very beginning, the first 10 days or so of the oil spill. After that, I think the federal government did a magnificent job of responding to the oil spill. The governors, particularly Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, took every opportunity to grandstand and to make it sound like, but for them, the entire coastline of the United States would be coated in oil. Probably was a minor shortage of boom. I wouldn't say a major shortage, but yeah, there probably should have could have been more boom, particularly early on. But boom is not 100% effective. It depends on the sea conditions, depends on the shoreline. There's a number of factors that are that go into whether or not oil spill boom works and can even be deployed. And the public, for the most part, wanted a solid curtain across the coastline that would prevent any oil from getting ashore, and that's not reality. As I said, some of the politicians seem to be appealing to public opinion rather than trying to help solve the problem.
Well, as long as we're on the oil spill, Dennis, I know you had some, I think I read a few things you wrote about the Jones Act and its applicability to the vessels that were being used or sought to be used to do oil recovery. Can you talk about that? As I understand it, you felt the Jones Act was not forbidding the use of foreign flag ships to do some of the work out there. Is that right?
I am unaware of any specific instance where the Jones Act prevented use of a foreign flag vessel that was offered for service to skim oil or take other action. The Jones Act prevents or limits the transportation of merchandise from one point in the United States to another point in the United States, except to vessels that are qualified under that statute. And basically, they've got to be built in the United States and owned by U.S. citizens. There were a number of foreign vessels that were used in response to the oil spill. The vessels that drilled the relief wells and most of their large support vessels were foreign flag. There was nothing that prevented their use. They were used. A number of foreign flag skimmers, specialized high sea skimmers, were used because they were operating more than 3 miles off the coast, and the Jones Act didn't apply to oil skimming more than 3 miles off the coast. The Jones Act only impeded, didn't even stop, but impeded oil skimming within 3 miles of the coast, and that was mostly done by fishing vessels, what the Coast Guard would call vessels of opportunity. There were plenty of U.S. flag fishing vessels. They didn't need foreign flag fishing vessels or small vessels like that to do skimming. There were various claims that I've read about the Jones Act impeding the process, and yet when you looked beyond the bare allegation, none of them were substantiated.
Well, let me follow on. This is sort of disconnected from that, but not really. Are you familiar with the Marine Highway concept, which would put I guess, ferries and the large numbers of what we call short sea shipping boats out in the offshore waters, littoral waters, where they would ease the burden on our highway system by carrying a lot of the cargo that could be carried by trucks. They could pick those up and take them from point A to point B along the coastline. And one of the arguments now seems to be that the Jones Act makes the use of such vessels prohibitively expensive because U.S. shipyards aren't very efficient, don't produce the kind of vessels that are needed, and it'd be a lot better if we could kind of waive that requirement and get this short sea shipping. It's easy for me to say, going in violation of the Jones Act, and kind of waive the Jones Act as far as this goes. So what's your view on that?
A difficult issue for which there's no easy answer. There's been talk of short sea shipping or the America's
You can't say
highway,
it either.
America's Marine Highway for years. It has proven to be very difficult to generate a sustained market for that activity. I mean, I would think that if we could load containers in Boston, let's say, and deliver them to Miami by ship, that would keep a whole lot of semis off the highway, particularly off I-95. The problem is that there's probably not a whole shipload of containers that need at any one time to be delivered from Boston to Miami. The semi carries one or two containers. A train carries a couple hundred containers, but they tend to stop along the way and drop some off, pick up some others, that sort of thing. And if you did that with a ship, it adds quite a bit to their expense. It's unfortunately a very, very complex market issues that are proving very, very difficult to solve. That, like I said, getting a shipload of containers, is there a shipload of containers in Boston that needs to be delivered to Miami right now? Probably not. Maybe a train load, but not a ship load. And that's the problem. There's a whole lot of people a lot smarter than me working on this issue and trying to develop a solution, and I wish them well. I think the higher operating costs of U.S. flag vessels is a factor, but not the most important factor in why short sea shipping hasn't taken off. It exists. There is a fair amount of short sea shipping going on, but not near as much as all of us would like to see. But the reasons for that are extremely complex.
Yeah, I think the part of the challenge is the economics of the situation, and it's not just like we've talked about here before with previous guests, the whole issue of wages and unions, but there's also the intermodal infrastructure you need to do that, and just the simple economics of it. But moving offshore here for a bit, especially in the last decade, we have seen a huge growth in unmanned vehicles. Everybody knows about the drones. But also with LCS and other platforms going forward, we're seeing an expansion of underwater autonomous vehicles. And we look back about a month to 6 weeks ago, then one of the Navy's UAVs, the Fire Scout, the Hilo, decided it would go take a visit of the Chesapeake Bay corridor up to Potomac and back before they finally got it under control. And things in the air are easier to get hold of when they disappear or to find when they go away than something that's underwater. And I would think, especially in the commercial realm as those expand, but also military, that has to be a growth area for law, both nationally and internationally. What moves have we seen to try to address those underwater autonomous vehicles, and what are some of the challenges from a legal perspective that still need to be fixed?
Well, let's take the floating surface autonomous vehicles. There are efforts underway right now to amend the collision regulations, the rules of the road for ships, to address these autonomous vessels, because you know they're out there operating in the same waters as manned vessels, and yet you know there is no one on board, and how do you address those issues? I mean, what constitutes a proper lookout on an unmanned vessel? So the maritime legal community is looking at that right now, and it's sort of like the unmanned aircraft. They face a similar legal conundrum. The underwater autonomous vessels, I think, are a large growth area for both the industry and the military. The industry is using them for things such as the energy sector, to do a lot of the work to respond to the Gulf oil spill. Autonomous underwater vehicles were used to a great extent to shut down that well. I think in today's economic climate for the military, we're going to see a lot of emphasis put on that, as we see with drones being used in Afghanistan. I think we're going to see unmanned autonomous vessels used by the military to replace these very, very expensive nuclear submarines with their highly trained crews. A small unmanned underwater vessel can do a lot of the work, particularly intelligence gathering, that you would otherwise be using a billion-dollar nuclear submarine to do. So I think we're going to see a growth in that sector, driven both by the technology and the economics.
Eagle One?
Well, this is different, but I want to talk about your experience with the SS Manhattan and the passage, the Great Northwest Passage, or whatever they call that up there, and what that says about, as the Arctic ice seems to be shrinking, what that says about the future of exploration up there and development of things like the oil fields and other stuff that we believe to be below that ice. What say you about that?
Well, there's a lot of talk of year-round navigation in the Arctic and vessels transiting from the Atlantic to the Pacific across the North Pole and stuff. I for one, don't think we're going to see that in our lifetime. The ice is still too formidable for that, and will remain so. The maritime industry, the commercial sector, needs certainty, needs predictability. They need to know that when they load a cargo in Germany and need to deliver it to China, that the route they choose is going to be a safe and reasonable route. You can't say that about the Arctic. You may, under certain conditions, on certain days, and with a certain ship, be able to move through the Northwest Passage, or maybe in 20 years straight over the pole. But you can't say that you can do that on a regular basis, day in and day out. So I don't think we're going to see commercial sea routes used on a regular basis in the Arctic. What we're going to see, though, is the Arctic will be a destination, not a route. That we're going to see more and more oil and gas production. There are huge amounts of minerals in the Arctic, some of which are already being extracted and removed with very little publicity, but we're going to see more of that going on. And occasionally we're going to see commercial ships operate in the Arctic as a shortcut, if you will. But for the most part, we're going to see ships up there working on oil drilling, gas drilling, and minerals extraction, fisheries. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration just some months ago set up its first Arctic Ocean fisheries regime. Previously, there was so little commercial fishing up there that it was basically unregulated. They finally recognized that the fishing industry is going up there and catching fish, and it needs to be regulated. So we are seeing more of that. We're going to, you know, it'll continue to expand, but in my opinion, there will be no regular sea routes through the Arctic in our lifetime.
You know, we think of exploiting the Arctic, you know, certain nations come to mind, Americans, the Canadians, the Russians, the Danes, the Norwegians. But when you fold in there going after raw materials and resources globally, the Chinese break out from the background noise there. But the Chinese also really don't have much of a history or experience working in the Arctic environment. Have we seen any moves from the Chinese to get in the international waters, the Arctic game, to try to get access to those resources as well?
Some. They're starting to operate ice-strengthened vessels. So, yes, there is some of that, and I think as we see more and more commercial activity in the Arctic, we're going to see the Chinese who are very interested in raw materials, not only oil and gas, but also iron ore, nickel, things of that nature. I think we're going to see them increasingly in the Arctic, but they don't need to go themselves. This is a commercial world, and while China is not a democracy, they certainly are very commercially oriented, and so they can hire ships from other nations to do that work for them. Not an issue. It's not a case where they've got to go themselves to do it. But yes, they are starting to build and operate some ice-strengthened vessels. But we're going to see them much more frequently chartering ice-strengthened vessels to operate up there for them.
Well, there has been some discussion of the Chinese asserting that they, like Russia and the United States and Canada and the other countries that actually border the Arctic Sea, that they have some right to that area. Do you have any idea what they base that assertion of a right on?
Well, they certainly have the right to operate in those waters, particularly outside the territorial sea of the littoral states. The law with regard to oil and gas extraction in offshore waters on the outer continental shelf is extremely clear, and they would have no right in that regard other than what they could lease from the littoral state, which is certainly possible, but I think unlikely. I don't think we're going to see them asserting an unqualified right to oil and gas extraction on the outer continental shelf of the U.S., Canada, or Russia, or whichever, because that would come back to haunt them in their home waters. Some other country would have the right to extract oil and gas from the Chinese outer continental shelf. So, now I don't think that's going to be the issue so much as the right to navigate through those waters, and that would, in some cases, require them to navigate through the territorial sea of the United States and/or Russia, if you're talking about the Bering Straits, which are very narrow. Then the issue arises about the Northeast Passage and the Northwest Passage, and whether those are open to navigation. Once again, it's not energy extraction. I don't think that's a matter of debate, but there is some unsettled question about the legal status of the Northeast Passage and Northwest Passage. The Russians would assert that there's no right of navigation through the Northeast Passage without their permission. Canada has taken the same position with the Northwest Passage. Neither one has been fully accepted by the international community, but on the other hand, we haven't seen vessels go through, particularly the Northeast Passage, without the permission and cooperation of the Russians. There were a couple of voyages last year that were with the full permission, cooperation, and escort of the Russians.
How would those passages be any different, in your view, than any other strait or restricted water, you know, that normally we view as being open for mariners to transit for peaceful purposes?
Well, the difference is historic. Because they've been icebound for many, many years, we haven't seen any commercial activity in those waters other than going there as a destination. No one up until very recently was running ships through the Northeast Passage commercially as a means of getting from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Generally, historically, the concept of Straits Passage was viewed as something that had been done for years, and as the territorial sea expanded, they created the specific rite of Straits Passage to preserve what had been happening for centuries in most cases, so that the expanded territorial sea claims didn't prevent those continued passages. There were no continued passages through the Northeast Passage or the Northwest Passage, and that's the hook on which Russia and Canada have made their claims. The United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, though, doesn't really use those words and doesn't require a historic basis, and that's where we're seeing some disagreement between those two governments and other governments. I would note that we are seeing vessels go through the Northwest Passage much more frequently than we used to, and I've seen a number of cruise ships go through the Northwest Passage. Things one in fact got grounded for about 10 days in the Canadian waters this last summer. But all of those transits have been done with the permission of the Canadian government. So it's still a very difficult issue, and we're going to have to build a better track record to see how this is going to shake itself out. But the vast majority of commercial operations in the Northeast Passage and Northwest Passage are going there as a destination. They're going there for energy extraction, mineral extraction, fisheries, things of that nature. They're not. Most of the ships up there are not going there to get from the Atlantic to the Pacific. They're going there because that's where they're doing their business.
Is another economic activity on the high seas that seems to often generate into the Admiralty Lawyer Full Employment Act. And I know we've seen the last couple of years recently, the Spanish specifically have gotten real excited about their 400 to 500 to 600-year-old shipwrecks. I believe it was a British company that found one of the Spanish ships that sunk in the early 1500s. And it was something I think even WikiLeaks couldn't get hold of where they actually found that. Now, that's an old-school salvage, but there's also salvage in a modern sense. Where is the law heading with regard to salvage, and when can a country like Spain realistically be able to claim something from a years or a location point of view, and when does it go to what most people would think of, if it's at the bottom of the sea, it's theirs?
Another sticky issue that's unsettled. I would note that the federal court in Tampa, Florida, which is handling that, I think it's euphemistically called the Black Pearl case that you referred to, just recently ruled that the Spanish government has the right to the salvage of that vessel. Now, salvage law is very arcane, and generally, the general process is that the salvor salves the cargo, the ship, whatever it is, and brings it into court and says, I salved this. I basically saved it from the ocean floor, and I want you, judge, to adjudicate the rights to this. I'm not claiming that I'm the owner of it. I'm claiming I'm the salvor of it, and that's the distinction. The owner is still the owner. Whoever owned it, be it the Titanic, be it the Black Pearl, whatever, they are the continued owner of that, unless they've abandoned it. and the salvor is entitled to salvage rights because they were the ones who basically brought it up off the floor of the ocean and brought it into court, either actually or judicially. Depending upon a large variety of factors, how long it was there, how difficult the salvage effort was anyone else trying to recover it, these sorts of things, the salvor can be entitled to the vast majority of the salvage property as their salvage award, not as any ownership right, but as a salvage award. And the owner can only recover the property if they pay the salvage award. I would presume that in the Black Pearl case, because the Spanish government had not made any great effort to recover it and probably didn't have the capability of recovering it, whereas this private company did, that we're going to eventually see a very large salvage award to that company. But it will be a salvage award. It will not be a case of finders keepers where they found this property and acquire ownership. No, they acquire a salvage award.
When you one of the things we haven't talked about, I mean, we're talking about salvage, but the other aspect of salvage is before it gets there, a lot of ships are being recycled. Some of them are run up on a beach in Bangladesh or someplace, and it looks like thousands of little minions run out and start stripping them off. What is going on with that stuff? What's your view on that?
Well, the scrapping industry, or what used to be called wrecking, now it's or breaking, and now they like to call it recycling, has been largely unregulated for years. We're now seeing more and more regulations being adopted domestically and internationally, and the environmental standards for ships that are to be recycled and for the recycling process are greatly increasing. And for your listeners, probably the takeaway on this aspect is that it applies to the Navy. In 2005, the French Navy arranged for their decommissioned aircraft carrier, the Clemenceau, to be recycled in India, and had the Clemenceau towed all the way to India for recycling. It got there, and the environmental interests in India said, "Hold it! You know, you've still got a lot of PCBs and asbestos and other stuff on board, and we challenge your right to have it recycled in India." They went to court. The Supreme Court of India upheld the claims of the environmental interests, and the French had to tow the Clemenceau back to France, and it's being recycled in Europe in a very expensive shipyard in the UK. This same situation will apply to U.S. Navy vessels and Coast Guard vessels that are decommissioned. We are no longer seeing these vessels sold strictly for turning into razor blades. We are seeing it become a very expensive process to get rid of old ships, including military vessels.
And speaking of expensive processes, we're coming out to the end of the show. I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas. And Dennis, thank you very much for coming on Midrax.
Okay, my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis.
And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year's to all.
Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame for love.